Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We just wanted to assure all New Yorkers that the standard protocols, if someone is sick and there's a possibility of spreading what could be the flu, we suggest that they stay home.
Governor Patterson on the swine flu. Let's talk about the science of swine flu now with Ian Lipkin, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Dr. Lipkin, thank you for coming on WNYC. Good morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
And we're going to open up the phones here because there's been so much fast and loose information, I think, flying out of all kinds of media organizations that people are probably very confused about what this is, what this isn't, how afraid they could be or should be. So your questions about the swine flu outbreak and swine flu as a disease at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's start very basically. Why is it called swine flu? What do pigs have to do with it?
Well, it's called swine flu because we isolate this virus from pigs, and pigs serve as what we call reservoirs, and the virus gets carried from pigs to people, primarily by contact between people and pigs, and then if it's capable of spreading person to person, it goes person to person thereafter.
Well, the most common contact between people and pigs is eating them. Can you get it by eating pork?
No. These are people who are taking care of pigs, so this is people caring for these animals in agriculture.
So there's no risk from ingestion of pork of any kind? Because, again, you know, I say a lot of the media reports on things very loosely without science backgrounds, whatever. And one of the things I heard this morning somewhere was, well, there shouldn't be a risk, but it's always a good idea to make sure your pork is cooked to 160 degrees internal temperature. That may be a good idea, but that has absolutely nothing to do with transmission of swine flu?
Well, these are two separate issues. You need to cook meat because if you don't cook meat, there are all sorts of microorganisms that exist within it that are potential risks. I don't think that handling pork that you would get from grocery stores is a real risk. The real risk in flu season is, of course, contact with other people who are infected with the virus.
And we're hearing that this is unique or unusual for having genetic material from pigs and humans and birds. Can you explain what that mix means?
Well, the flu is a very wily organism. What it does is to evade our immune systems and to reproduce itself. It acquires genetic information from pigs and who may actually be carrying several different strains of a virus, and it swaps out its genes and it's able to grow more efficiently as a result of that genetic swapping. I don't mean to imply that this is something the virus does deliberately. It's a function of evolution. There's natural selection for strains that are more resistant to the immune system. Those are the ones that take off and are spread most effectively. Now, you said something just as we were coming on the air, which I think is reason to be less concerned than we might otherwise be. That is, you say it's going to be another hot day in New York. I think you mentioned 88 degrees.
Uh-huh.
For many years, we've been aware of the fact that flus spread much more efficiently during winter months. So we typically see them in northern latitudes, November to March, and in southern latitudes, May to September. So if you're in Australia, your risk is different than if you live in New York. And the question, of course, as to how this might be explained has been puzzling us for many, many years. A colleague of mine, Peter Polesi at Mount Sinai, a couple of years ago, did a very nice controlled study to examine this question using animal models. And what he learned was that there was a dramatic decrease in the capacity of virus to spread from person to person. Well, he was using guinea pigs as a model. But as the temperature went up and as the humidity went up, and he tested a number of possibilities, it turns out that there are two separate aspects that are important. One is that as the humidity goes up, the viral particles get heavier, they settle out, they're less likely to remain airborne. And when you're dealing with colder temperatures, the amount of virus that shed in the respiratory tract of humans and animals of other types is also higher. So as we move from cold to warmer seasons and as humidity goes up, the risk drops.
Right. But let me ask you about that. And by the way, I think it's going to be 83 today in New York, 88 tomorrow. So I don't want to give out any bad weather information by 5 degrees. But if that's really the case, then why is this flu so prevalent in Mexico, where presumably it's usually warm weather?
Well, humidity is the other aspect that I described.
Yeah.
And if you actually look at rainfall, there isn't much in February and March, even in Mexico City. As you start moving into April, May, June, you get far more precipitation.
I see. But
so
then
humidity,
this,
yeah.
Got
so.
It. So this brings up another question that I had from reading the press, because I had seen something yesterday that was talking about swine flu and saying, in these ways, it does or it doesn't act like seasonal flu. And I thought, well, is that distinction accurate, or is this a kind of seasonal flu? So did you just say that it really is a kind of seasonal flu?
Well, everything that's abnormal at the start eventually, you know, has a high risk of becoming a seasonal flu. As we become develop immunity to these viruses or to related viruses, they become more seasonal. We don't see these abrupt increases in morbidity and mortality. Though even in a normal year, we have something like 40,000 people in the U.S. alone who die from flu. So flu is not benign, but that typically hits people who are infirm or somewhat older. In this case, we're seeing some young people who are being affected as well. Now, you know, we're talking about...
How do you explain that? That's one of the most unusual things about this, because when you look at who is supposed to get the flu vaccine in the United States each year, and you're right to say, and we talked about this some last hour, that all influenza has a death rate, so we probably don't even know whether this is a more virulent strain of flu, a deadlier strain of flu than any other, because we really don't know the death rate yet. We don't know how many cases of this swine flu are out there, so whether these 100 deaths in Mexico represent 100 out of 1,000, which would be highly deadly, or 100 out of 1,000,000, which wouldn't be very deadly at all. Do you have any idea? But then why would it affect the younger, healthier population, since, again, we generally immunize against flu in populations considered to be more vulnerable, those over 50, those very, very young, those with asthma or other compromised respiratory symptoms. So what's your best guess as to how to solve that mystery of the, you know, the 35-year-old males who are dying of this?
Well, there's several factors that come into play. One of them, as you said, is the capacity of somebody to respond to an infectious agent. This is what we like to refer to as innate immunity, your ability to mount a response irrespective of the virus or the bacterium, for that matter. People are more susceptible to bacteria in those extremes of age as well. But in addition, people get exposed to viruses over the course of their lifetime. And if somebody saw a virus 25 years ago that looks somewhat like this virus, they may have the capacity to mount a specific immune response that can be protective, whereas an individual who's younger may not have seen this at all. So that's, you know, so there are several aspects. One is, what is your capacity to mount or, you know, an immune response from the, you know, from the get-go, never having seen anything like this in the past? Have you seen anything like this in the past? And of course, in addition, there's exposure. You have to be exposed. So there are a number of viral diseases and bacterial diseases where people just don't encounter the agent, so they don't show signs of infection. So we don't really understand until we get more information on how this disease initiated, how many people have been infected or exposed, and whether or not older people who have, you know, we collect blood from them and we test their ability to recognize this new strain of flu, whether or not they simply have partial protection. So it's still early days in understanding this outbreak.
And on the deadliness of this, you know, NPR is putting out a journalistic guideline not to call this a deadly virus for precisely the reason that I was saying before. We don't really know the prevalence rate of the virus, so we don't know if this is more deadly than any other kind of flu, or if we're just being scared by a relatively small number of deaths that are being reported in a sensationalistic way. Do you have an opinion about this as a public health expert?
I think that's accurate. You know, we don't have enough information to make an informed comment on that until, you know, we do need to know how many people have been exposed, and we need to have some, you know, again, you've got a numerator. You don't have a denominator, so you can't express things in terms of percentages. Nonetheless, I think it does drive home a number of points, which I think you should emphasize for your listeners. First of all, you know, when we start thinking about vaccinations, the vaccine that we're now using is not ideally suited for this particular strain of flu.
You mean this year's version of the flu vaccine?
Correct. I mean, you know, we make decisions about what is going to be used in a vaccine twice a year, in February, typically in February and September. So the World Health Organization and the Food and Drug Administration make decisions in February about what's going to be used in that winter season. That's for the Northern Hemisphere. And in September, the same exercise is done for the Southern Hemisphere. And the reason is that we need a certain amount of time to make those vaccines, to validate them, to make sure they're safe, and to distribute them. Now, we still make vaccines, for the most part, using technology that hasn't changed in decades. So it takes a long time to ramp up and to produce new vaccines. But there are next-generation vaccines that many of us in the field have been trying to get us to move toward, and I think this is an excellent argument for it. In the best-case scenario, there's been one manufacturer who said that it would take a minimum of 4 months to be able to make a vaccine to this new strain. Now, with some of these next-generation technologies, that time can be shortened dramatically. Now, we do have drugs to treat this as well, so I don't want everyone to think that we don't have anything in our arsenal to deal with this agent.
Mostly Tamiflu and what is it called, Refluenza or something?
Right. So you know, there's another class of drugs which is not effective, but there are others that are. So, you know, I think we have, you know, we do have some safety net, if you will.
And again, it's worth reminding everybody that the only cases that have been confirmed in New York are 8 children from a high school in Queens, none of whom are seriously ill. And on this basis, the European Union is recommending to all its citizens that they not fly to New York or anywhere in the United States and Mexico at this time. And on that note, we take our first call for Ian Lipkin, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, from Sue, calling from Paris, France. Are you really in Paris, Sue?
I sure am.
I'm glad you're
Bonjour,
listening.
Monsieur, comment allez-vous? Hello,
Très
I'm
bien.
Calling because
Merci.
I'm curious to know,
et vous?
What is the incubation time when one has been exposed to this virus and can pass it on to a third party without even having yourself become sick yet?
Dr. Lipkin?
Yeah, the incubation period is a couple to a few days. And you have to be symptomatic in order to pass this virus because it typically spreads as respiratory droplets. So you should have some upper respiratory symptoms. Okay. It's not, for example, something like herpes virus or hepatitis C or hepatitis B where you might transmit something unwittingly by blood transfusion. This is spread by respiratory by respiratory droplets in contact.
So you already have to feel pretty miserable before you're going to pass it on.
Well, you know, some people don't feel as miserable as others.
I have to take a plane from Paris to New York at the end of the week to visit my 97-year-old mother. And the last thing I want to do is pick up a bug on a plane and give it to her.
I understand your point. You know, what you can do, and this is also controversial, but some people wear masks. It's very, very common in Japan during seasonal influenza and other respiratory infections that you see people wearing masks. And, you know, people will look at you strangely, but if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it. The other thing is just common sense. You know, wash your hands frequently to make sure that you're not transmitting anything to yourself. And though that's really not the major mechanism for transmission.
Certainly not on an airplane.
But I don't think that this is a major issue here in New York. Now, when SARS struck, as you remember, you know, there was an embargo on travel to Toronto, I think longer than it should have been in place, and so forth. But there we were dealing with an agent that I think we understood a bit better. I mean, there was far better data on morbidity and mortality, and it was a very different situation. So, you know, I don't think the same thing pertains here.
So,
then again, I'm living in New York.
Sue, good luck. Thank you very much for calling in. Good luck deciding whether to come to visit your 97-year-old mother. Dr. Lipkin, you mentioned the masks. They're giving out masks a lot in Mexico City, I understand. Are they effective against something like this?
They can be effective. I mean, they're, you know, with SARS, for example, there was a specific type of mask that people were using. It's called an N95 mask. But nobody's really, there's no evidence yet that this virus is as contagious as was SARS, for example. We don't have any evidence that there are people like these super spreaders that were described in the time of SARS. I just don't see this thing going into a full-blown pandemic. It just doesn't look that way to us.
Let's take a phone call about another outbreak of swine flu that Joel in Fresh Meadows remembers. Joel, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guest. As a person who lives five blocks from St. Francis Prep, I certainly have a keen interest in what's going on here. And my question to your guest is this. About 30 years ago, in 1978, there was another swine flu
Right, swine flu. They gave immunizations at the time, right?
Immunizations. And my question is how does this virus compare to that virus? And if you were immunized against that, would you have any degree of protection to the current strain?
That's a great question, because there were so many people who were immunized back then, and so they may be wondering as well. Dr. Lipkin.
I wish I could give you a comprehensive answer to that. In fact, we have to go back and examine individuals who were around in 1978 who might have encountered that flu and find out whether or not they have immune responses that are capable of neutralizing this particular strain of virus. What happens is that from year to year, there are changes, and sometimes in longer intervals, where there's a major change in the nature of the virus. Again, this is a result of the escape of something from the immune system, and, you know, in a large number of people who've never seen it before, and then you see an outbreak of many, many more cases. So that presumably is what's happened here. There may have been people who've seen this virus in the past somewhere else in the world, and they're just not showing signs of a major outbreak. But because it's new here and because it's new in Mexico and there isn't any pre-existing immunity, it looks like it's a major outbreak. So until we have more information about immunological responses to this flu versus previous flus, we just can't answer those questions.
We're getting a lot of questions about travel. We heard from Sue in Paris, concerned about her 97-year-old mother. Dory in Brooklyn, I think, has an almost opposite concern. Hi, Dory.
Hi. I'm going to be traveling with my 5-month-old next week, and I'm concerned about how easily she may pick up this virus. And then I'm also wondering if the airliners are doing anything to clean their planes better than they were previously doing in light of this, and if there's anything in particular I should be, how is there any way I can protect my child?
Dr. Lipkin?
Good questions. I don't know what the airlines are doing. As you know, they're all under, you know, cost constraints right now. So I don't know that they have a lot of flexibility to do very much, and it's not clear yet what they could do, even if they needed to do so. During the SARS epidemic of, 2003, there were documented cases of transmission to people on airlines, but they were not very common. There are other respiratory pathogens that are transmitted more commonly. I'm afraid I don't really have any great advice. Do you really need to travel at this point with a 5-month-old? Or is that something you could put off? It would be a question I would ask myself.
Right. I mean, it would be, it's like a loss of money, but it's not important if it's relative to her health.
So
that's the
discussion
that my husband and I have been having.
There's really no way to calculate that risk, because we don't know if there's going to be anyone on that plane, not only with flu, but with something else that might pose a risk.
Dory, thank you very much, and good luck to you. Here's a question from our website, Dr. Lipkin. It says, my family was in Mexico City over spring break. We've been home more than a week and no symptoms, but I don't want to endanger anyone, especially at my child's school. Am I right that the incubation period is only 48 hours and we are in the clear?
If you're healthy over a week at home at this point, you're in the clear.
Also from our website, why are the Mexicans getting so much sicker than Americans?
Well, they may be the only ones seeing this particular virus. They may not have...
Well, apparently it's been confirmed that it's the same strain, at least in the New York cases, as has been diagnosed in Mexico. Is that your understanding?
Well, even small differences in the genetics of an organism can have a profound effect on its behavior. So I haven't seen all the sequence data yet. We're only just beginning to look at that. So there may be small modifications in the information that the virus carries with it that can have a profound effect on its capacity to cause disease. The other thing, as I said earlier, is that pre-existing immunity can modify the illness. So if we have people who've been vaccinated more efficiently in the past, even if they don't have complete protection, they may have partial protection. And sometimes that's all you really get with a vaccination. You get a partial protection so you don't have severe disease or fatal disease.
Do you think that the precautions that they're taking in Mexico City are over the top? They have shut down the schools through May 5th. There's a report now in the last few minutes that they're considering shutting down the subway system in Mexico City. Yesterday they recommended that people stay home from church, stay home from soccer games. Is this over the top, in your opinion, based on the actual outbreak as it's been measured so far?
I wouldn't second guess the decisions of a public health authority person in Mexico City or anywhere else if they were faced with an outbreak. We just don't know what it looks like on the ground there. And again, they may not, as I said, they may not have a population with the same sort of pre-existing immunity that we have. They may be concerned about the political fallout, the economic fallout. They want to contain it as rapidly as possible. And this clearly indicates that they are responding in a very vigorous fashion to control this. Remember, in 1999, when we had the first bird flu epidemic or outbreak in Hong Kong, then the current director of WHO, who was then director of health in Hong Kong, decided over a period of only a few days that she was going to close down all the wild animal markets, shut down the bird markets. She responded very, very quickly, very, very effectively, and contained what could have been a major outbreak. And I think the Mexican government is being appropriate in doing that. It's just not what we confront here.
And what about the U.S. government, because the government has declared what they call a public health emergency, which I think is a scarier sounding term than what it means technically in the world of public health. But here are some of the recommendations from Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano.
We need everybody in the United States to take some responsibility. If you are sick, stay home, wash your hands, take all of those reasonable measures that will help us mitigate how many people actually get sick in our country.
It's so ordinary. If you're sick, stay home, wash your hands, which everybody should do anyway. If you have a five-month-old, probably best not to take the five-month-old on the plane anyway, unless you really need to. So what does it mean that we're in an official public health emergency in the United States?
I think it's well put. She's told people to take certain kinds of common sense measures to avoid risk of infection. One of the problems we have in our culture is that we think only about ourselves. We don't think about infecting others. When we started initially talking about H5N1 a few years ago, I made this point about now, perhaps we should use an Indian greeting, just namaste, just put your hands together, bow, and forget about handshakes. I mean, handshakes really go back to the Middle Ages when you wanted to show somebody you didn't have a weapon in your right hand. Well, we don't really necessarily need to do that in this instance. So I think what she's saying is right on target. If you're sick, stay home. But that's good advice, as you've said, at any time.
All right. Well, you know what? We're going to leave it there. And with tremendous amounts of uncertainty here, perhaps some overreaction, perhaps some sensationalized reporting. Remember, folks, all we have in New York City is 8 confirmed cases that are all said to be mild in one school in Queens. And we will see what happens from this point. Mayor Bloomberg will be holding a news conference at 12:30 this afternoon. And, of course, we will be reporting on it here at WNYC. And I want to thank Dr. Ian Lipkin, Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, for answering so many of our questions about swine flu this morning. Thank you very much, Dr. Lipkin.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up. two segments from two different altitudes. The FAA reports on the potential for more bird strikes. Kennedy Airport has the nation's highest risk, they have determined. And Thursday is the deadline for NASA to decide whether to end the space shuttle program. But NASA currently has no leader. Stay with us. Bird strikes next.